Welcome to The Forum on 90.5 WCBE. Every week, we bring you the conversations that shape Columbus, straight from the Columbus Metro Club's Wednesday networking luncheons downtown. The Forum is where leaders, thinkers, and community voices like yours come together to tackle the issues that matter most to Central Ohio. Want to join us in person? Tickets and details about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. AI is getting smarter, but are we? What if the future doesn't belong to people who can out-calculate machines, but to people who can out-imagine them? In a world dominated by algorithms and automation, what makes us irreplaceably human? We're finding out this week from our featured panelist, Angus Fletcher, professor of story science in the Department of English at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of the new book, Primal Intelligence. Your host is Siraj Hinduja, managing director of RTRX. Let's dive into this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Primal Intelligence, the Human Edge in an AI World.
It's great to be here with you, Angus. I will give an insight to the audience that Angus and I actually were traveling together a couple days ago. We literally got off the plane yesterday at like 2 in the afternoon, and here we are again. We were down in Austin, Texas, taking his work to a group of HR and cultural leaders. My favorite thing about Angus's book is the book cover that reminds me that I am, in fact, smarter than I think every day. But we're excited to have you here, Angus. I would like to start with your origin story and how you ended up here in Columbus, Ohio, at The Ohio State University.
The best place on earth.
Very much so, the best place on earth.
That's a great question. And normally when I answer this question, I talk a lot about how I started out in neuroscience and then I went off to Yale and I got my PhD in Shakespeare and all this kind of stuff. But I think maybe since we have so many of our future college students here in the room with us today, I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, my actual origin story when I was 17 years old and I got to college. And I was so excited to get to college because I've been told the whole time that I was in high school that this is where your life starts. And it's so amazing. And I had so many older people come up to me and they'd be like, oh, it was the best years of my life. You're going to love it so much. And I got to college and I hated it.
You hated it?
I hated it. I thought it was like high school, only more disorganized. So, you know, the problem with high school is you're always being forced to learn all this stuff that you don't really care about and also has no relationship to reality. Not your high school, of course. But I'm just talking about the high school that I went to. And so you spend all this time taking all these standardized tests and memorizing all these things. And you're like doing it because you're like, oh, finally I'm going to get free and I'm going to get to go to college and it's going to be amazing. And then, you know, I got to a great college, went to, you know, one of the top schools in America. And I got there. And after just a couple days of classes, I was like, I have had enough. I've had enough of this because once again, I'm being told a bunch of stuff. Unlike my high school teachers, my college professors, I don't know if you've ever met a college professor. I happen to be a college professor, so you probably get a pretty good sense of the fact that, you know, we as college professors like to pretend we're like too important to do things like prepare, you know, have a syllabus, think about what our students might actually be expecting from us, sort of show up at the last minute. And so I was, you know, very demoralized. And I was like, what is happening here? And I sort of felt, and I think this is a feeling that a lot of young people have today, that like no one's kind of in charge. And that there's all these parts of American life that are overstructured, but in a way that is out of touch with reality. And then there's just a bunch of like chaos and anarchy happening everywhere else. And you're like, what's going on here, you know? And so I just had this kind of existential crisis. And I remember going back to my dorm room, you know, and picking up the phone, calling my mom, because who do you call in those moments of crisis? Your mom or, you know, your other sort of, you know, parent figure. I call my mom and I'm like, Mom, I'm dropping out of college. And she was like, what?
This was on day three?
Yeah, this was day three, day four, basically.
Cool.
Yeah. No, it was great. Also, they'd driven me like 500 miles to get there, you know, and then they basically just got the station wagon back home. I'm like, yeah, I'm dropping out. Mom's like, what? You know, what's the plan? I mean, the plan is I'm dropping out. Plan is I'm dropping out. And I never forget what she said to me right after that. There was like a long pause of calls because she's like collecting her thoughts. I think she was trying to like realize that she couldn't just like yell at me, you know, which would have been kind of, you know, I'm sure what she wanted to do, you know. There's a long pause and she goes, let me ask you a question. Don't you think that there's one person in that huge, big campus that you could learn something from? Hmm. And I said, yeah. And then she goes, go find them. And then she hung up the phone.
So who was that one person? Did you find them?
I ended up finding that person, but it was kind of an odyssey because this was back before really, I mean, the internet existed, but we couldn't like search for stuff all the time. We didn't have phones and things like that. And so basically I was on this huge campus filled with all these like big intimidating buildings that, you know, they, you know, had stuff on the walls of them. And what I was really most interested in at that time in my life and still most interested in now is the human brain. And the reason I'm so interested in the human brain is the world is full of so many people who I deeply admire, both alive and in past lives, who have created so much extraordinary art, technology, science, these amazing things. And I'm always like, how does that come out of the human brain? Like, how do humans do that? And then I look inside my own brain and I see how much stupidity there is in there, how much kind of like laziness. And I'm like, how do I get that stuff out of there? Like, how do I, you know? And so I want to understand the brain. I want to understand how to work better. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to find a neuroscience lab on campus. And so I didn't go to class the next day. I just, you know, started walking around campus trying to find a neuroscience lab. And back then, this was not an easy task to do. This was kind of before, you know, they invited undergraduates in. And I went around to a lot of these buildings and couldn't get into any of them, you know, or there just wasn't anybody there or whatever. And then I had a big twist of luck. And the twist of luck was I was going by the medical school campus. And the medical school campus, they do a lot of experiments on animals. So actually, no one who doesn't have a security badge is allowed inside the building. So there was no way that I was going to get in the building. But I didn't know this because I arrived at the side of the medical school just at the same moment that someone was walking out of one of the doors and held it open for me.
So you snuck in.
Yes.
You had to.
Yes, I broke in. That's right. I was a criminal interloper in the medical school. So I walk in and then I just start like wandering around and finally I ended up on the top floor, one of the top, as it turned out, neurophysiology labs in the world. Neurophysiology is where you study the living brain. So, you know, if you go to a psychology lab, there's a lot of people sort of like thinking about how the brain works, and then they run a bunch of MTurk studies or something like that. I'm not to get too gory about what happens in neurophysiology labs, but they actually have alive brains in the labs, and they're literally looking at them, and they're kind of studying how they work. And so I walk into this lab at the age of 17, and I'm like, can I have a job here? And they were so startled, they thought I must be like a medical student or a PhD student or something like that, because no undergraduate had ever arrived in this lab in history. And so like, okay. And so they got me all set up. And the reason I tell you that story is a couple things. First of all, initiative. Initiative, that's the thing that school beats out of you. School makes you think that the answer is inside school. School makes you think that the answer is inside the system. What's the number one thing that school teaches you? It teaches you that there's an answer and the system has it. And so the more time you spend in school as a young person today, the more dependence you develop, the more anxiety you develop, the more that you feel like if you don't know the answer, you better go run and ask an adult for help. That's the opposite of how you learn. You learn by taking chances, by taking risks, by doing things. And I'm so grateful to my mom that she knew how to poke me in the right way to help me take that initiative. So I say to you as a young person right now, don't listen to your elders when they tell you what to do. Take a chance, take a risk in what you're reading. Take a book off the shelf that no one has recommended to you. Try it. Walk into a strange lab. Have a conversation with a strange person. And if you're trying to mentor a young person, don't take away their initiative by telling them about how you did it, you know? Don't take away their initiative by giving them all the answers. Instead, give them a poke, hang up the phone, force them to kind of find their way. And so the first thing is initiative, and then the second thing is luck. Nobody successful likes to admit that they're here because they're lucky. Success comes from luck. Now, you gotta have the initiative to get the luck, and you gotta be able to hang in there long enough to get the luck, so there are definitely things that contribute to success, like willingness to take a risk and resilience, but it does take luck. And I was lucky that that door was open at the right time for me. And I think everyone in this room who is successful has had that experience. If you walk into a place and the door just happens to be open and you walk through it. And for everyone out there who's not having that success right now, it's not on you. Keep having that initiative. Keep walking around campus. Keep trying to find that building. A door will open. The world is full of good people, and there is someone out there who will either open a door or hold it open for you long enough to go through it. You just got to keep trusting your luck.
Thank you. Let's stick with the neuroscience lab for a minute. Is the human brain rational? Are humans rational?
Well, I don't know if you've ever met a human, but the answer is no. And this is a great question because, you know, at the time that I was working in this neuroscience lab, this was the boom of something that was known as cognitive science, which is now really developed into the foundations of what we now call artificial intelligence or AI. And it's based on this idea that intelligence is the ability to make the right decision. And it's based on the idea that you make the right decision by having enough data. and you analyze the data objectively, and you arrive at the right decision. And all that is true in the sense that if you're in a situation where you have a lot of data, and it's good data, and you analyze it rationally, you'll probably make the right decision. The problem is, most of the time in life, there isn't enough data. There just isn't. And the human brain evolves in environments that were changing a lot, that were filled with volatility and uncertainty. I'm sure no one in this room knows what it's like to live in a volatile or uncertain world. We all know exactly what's gonna happen tomorrow. That's also how it was when our brains evolved, incredibly unstable environments. And so humans had to learn to be intelligent with very little information. And so a huge part of human intelligence is that ability to be smart when you don't have enough data to be rational or logical. Now, that's not to say that the human brain doesn't have the capacity to be rational or logical. You have a thing at the back of your brain. It's called the visual cortex. It's actually the most powerful computer in the world. It's really good at crunching data, crunching information. So if you go back even 500 million years before the human brain, just back to the origins of the neuron, we already had that computational capacity. But our brain realized that wasn't enough. That's why you have emotions. Emotions aren't just a heuristic. Emotions are also a form of intelligence. So one of the things that happened, I realized in the neuroscience lab, is that we'd become fixated on a single kind of intelligence. And it's the same thing with our school system now. We're fixated on IQ. And if you go and look at a book will tell you that IQ is the same as general intelligence. And that's wrong. IQ is your ability to be rational when you have enough information. There actually is no such thing as general intelligence. There's lots of different kinds of intelligence. That's why when you go through your life, you're going to meet all kinds of people who are smart in different ways. And actually, if you go out in the woods, right, if you go out for a walk in a forest, what you notice is there isn't one ultimate kind of tree, because what does nature do? It branches. It's the same thing with intelligence. Intelligence is all about realizing that life is about opportunities, and you're able to exploit opportunities by yourself being different, being unlike other people. And so, you know, part of the thing I started to realize in the neuroscience lab is we've constructed a society that's focused on optimization, standardization, efficiency, productivity, all things that technology does really well, and all things that can be very, very valuable. But we've lost sight of the fact that actually the true power of human intelligence is singularity, is originality. I mean, I hope everyone in this room has a friend who's different from them. And that friend is going to give you the best advice you never could have given yourself. And that's why human communities are so strong, because they cultivate and encourage diversity and difference and then have conversations between it. That's our superpower as humans. So that's what I sort of realized in the lab. And then I just realized that no one was studying that from a neuroscience perspective, and I wanted to get in on that.
So you went to study all of that in a neuroscience lab, and then you went and got a PhD in Shakespeare. And I connect the dots for me, for all of us, on why, and then what perspective that gave you on the human brain and on humans.
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. Well, so first of all, just a simple thing to say about it is one of the reasons I went to do Shakespeare from neuroscience is because it was totally different. And I've just sat here and told you that I think that's where intelligence comes from, is taking jumps and going to places where people think differently from you and having the courage to combine things that other people haven't put together before. So just on a basic level, you know, you don't have to study Shakespeare to understand how the world works, but you should study something that's very different from what you're studying now. You should always make that effort in life to kind of stretch yourself. So just on a basic level, that was kind of what was happening. But also, I started to realize that if sort of the secret to being a human is to be able to be smart with not a lot of information, I started to look around and I was like, well, who's able to be smart without a lot of information? And artists, entrepreneurs, nurses and teachers. We don't give nurses and teachers enough credit, but nurses are what make the healthcare system work. And the reason they make it work is because you have this system that's set up by an administrator at the top. And then you have all these doctors who are totally overspecialized and really know how to do one thing, you know? And then all these humans come into the building and create problems for the system. And who figures out how to actually make the system work? It's the nurses. The nurses are able to figure that same thing with teachers. You know, teachers are told, I've got to get these kids to take these tests. Every single kid is different from every other kid, you know? I've got to figure out how to activate that ability that I have to see what's special and unique in every individual. So I realized that those are the folks that were smart. And I thought to myself, you know, How do I study that kind of intelligence? How do I study the intelligence of an artist, of a teacher, of an entrepreneur? And then I just had this bonkers idea where I was like, I'll go study Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was an artist, he was an entrepreneur, he was a teacher, he did all these things. And also, luckily for me, Shakespeare wrote down all this stuff on pieces of paper, so I could just kind of study them. And instead of, like, you know, barging into a school and kind of, you know, disrupting how things are going, I can just hang out in the library and see if I have any insights. And so, luckily enough, I got to do that. And I did have a ton of insights about how Shakespeare worked. And then for the next 20 years, as we may or may not want to talk about, I then wandered, regarded as kind of an academic lunatic in the wilderness, trying to convince people that I had seen something that the system had not.
Well, we can't leave it at that. What did you see that the system had not? I can't just go switch to another topic after that.
So what I came to believe is that one of the reasons that humans are smart is because we think in story. And we misunderstand story in the modern world. We think story is a form of communication. Actually, you're thinking in story all the time as a human. Anytime you imagine your future, that's a story. So for an entrepreneur, long before you tell the story of your company to people, you've imagined it. At the end of the day, most of us reflect back on our day, and we think about the story of our day. The moment we meet a new person in our lives, we immediately are able to imagine a story of what the two of us are going to do together. That's why we get so excited when you make a new friend. So story is a form of intelligence. It's also famously a low information form of intelligence. People can create stories with very limited information. That's why stories are often wrong. And so the point isn't that stories are right, because right and wrong is something that comes from data and logic. The point is that stories are possible, and that people who are successful are able to imagine a lot of stories, as opposed to settling on a single story. And this is why when you look at children, children have enormous imaginative capacity. They're able to role play. You know, one minute they can be a firefighter. You know, next minute they can be a wizard. The next minute they can be an astronaut. The next minute they can be a dinosaur. You know, they're always able to imagine all these different kinds of possibilities. That's the power of story, is to always imagine a new option. That's what gives you the initiative. That's what keeps you going in times of crisis. And that's what we're losing in our modern world. The reason that people are so anxious and stressed out right now is we feel like we've lost the ability to come up with new stories. We feel like we're trapped in a set of stories we've seen before, and we know how they end, and we don't like how they end. And we're choosing between two bad stories. So I wanted to understand that. Shakespeare, obviously, well, this may or may not be obvious, because, you know, actually, when I was in school, I hated Shakespeare. I'm going to sort of get all this out here now. I loathed Shakespeare when I was a student. I didn't understand him. He seemed like really boring and long-winded. I felt like I was forced to read him, which is always a mistake in school, right? I mean, the most powerful thing you can do with a book is give someone the choice to read it. So I didn't like Shakespeare, but later when I studied him, I realized that what his genius was to figure out how to create new stories. He created all these stories that had never existed before. And this is the opposite of what I was taught in school. I was taught that Shakespeare was a timeless classic who resurrected the genius of the Romans and the Greeks, and he was part of a kind of like eternal archetype of civilization or something like that. And when you actually read Shakespeare, he's an incredibly experimental person. I don't know if any of you have ever met a theater person, but they're not archetypal, they're weird. I mean, that's like the defining quality of a theater person. And they're always trying to do something new and interesting. And it was the same as Shakespeare. It was like, how do I do something new? How do I do something interesting? So he invented the modern romantic comedy. He invented Die Hard. If you read Henry V, that's basically Die Hard. King Lear, he invented existential terror. Any modern horror movie, you can thank Shakespeare for that. So he just invented all these new stories. And I was like, how is he doing this? And that's why, it's kind of part of my odyssey, I ended up at Stanford for a while, and I got a chance to work with folks at Pixar. And that was at the time when they were making movies like Up. And if you've seen Up, you know, back before Pixar got destroyed by Disney, I won't go on a long rant about Disney. If you want to see that, you can see me on some podcasts where I talk about how much I dislike Disney. But, I will talk a little bit about Disney. Disney buys cool stuff and then they ruin it, right? By mass producing it and optimizing it. I mean, they destroy everything. So back in the day, what Pixar was doing is they're saying, how do we tell a new story? And so Up is a great example. We want to just tell like this weird story about like a balloon house and like an old guy and some kid that goes in this balloon house with him. And you know, what do we want the story to do? We want it to go up. Well, how are we going to make a story that goes up? We're going to tell you the saddest beginning of a story you've ever seen in your entire life. And we're going to take you down. And then we're going to surprise you with how low we can take you and then how high we can lift you. And then you're going to walk out of that theater feeling just a sense of exhilaration because you've rediscovered the emotional capacity of your mind. So they were just taking these huge risks at Pixar, but they were working. They were making new stories that were paying off. And so it was the same thing that I saw with Shakespeare. And so that was when I just became obsessed with this capacity of the human mind to do this thing that computers can't, because computers are data-driven. They can only see patterns in the past and tell you what the most probable thing is, as opposed to imagining something new that is possible. That was when I was like, how do we get more of that? Because kids today are suffering because they don't have it. Corporations are suffering today because they don't have it. People inside corporations are suffering because they're not given the opportunity to use that. And schools are really failing to cultivate that in young people. So how do we start to get more of that kind of like Shakespeare, kind of Pixar, kind of natural brain going?
And so in that journey of exploring the woods, you then started working with Special Forces.
That's right. I started working with the United States Army. That's right. You want me to tell that story?
Talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, I've been wandering in the wild for a while. I'm actually in LA, working at a university there, and I get a phone call from Ohio State. And not a lot of people know this about Ohio State, so I'm just going to plug Ohio State here, because Ohio State, we of course have the best football team, and we of course have the best many other sports teams. But we also have a lot of geniuses at Ohio State, a lot of the best in the world at things that nobody knows about. And so I got a phone call, shout out to Jim Phelan, a professor at Ohio State. He runs something called Project Narrative. It's the world's leading academic institute for the study of story. People are always like, wait, why does Ohio have the world's leading academic institute for the study of story? Well, the answer is because what drives story? Is it the storyteller? Partly, but also the audience. And a story is something that's co-created, because the best storytellers know how to listen deeply to the person they're telling the story to. And by listening to them, they sense, am I generating interest? Am I generating suspense? Am I generating surprise? And by building that connection with the audience, you build a new story, because that audience member is different from anyone that you've met before. So the reason that the world's best institute for studying story is here in Ohio is because we have the best audiences. And we really do. This is, just in terms of kind of how America works, sort of we've got the best mix, essentially, of different folks from the East, from the South, from the Midwest, different vibes, different communities. We've got a great kind of, as I'm sure you know, very diverse immigrant community here, surprising to people. And so that's why we're a test market. So for the same reason that we're a test market, Project Narrative is here. I get the phone call. Come join Project Narrative. I'm telling everyone at Project Narrative my zany theories. They're like, well, Angus, we of course agree with you because we're also zany and we're a group of very smart professors, but nobody believes us in the outside world. And so for my first few years at Ohio State, we were just kind of like running around the building together, sharing our crazy ideas. And then I get this phone call, you know, and it's like, Professor Fletcher. And I'm like, because nobody calls me that. They're usually like, hey, you kid over there. I'm like, yes. And they go, this is USASOC. Now, I'm not sure, I mean, we have a couple of military folks in here who know what USASOC is, but if you're not in the military, USASOC, what? You know, sounds like I'm telling you to use a sock. What? You know, so I'm like, okay, use a sock. They're like, no, Angus, you don't understand. This is United States Army Special Operations Command. I'm like, what's happening? So.
You thought it was an April Fool's joke?
I did actually. Well, I actually, it was scared that they were going to throw me out of the country, because I haven't told you guys in this form, I'm an immigrant. So I'm actually a naturalized American citizen. I came here from overseas. And I had this moment where I was like, oh no. And they're basically like, we've been watching you and your research. And I was like, oh my God, like what's going to happen to me? And the short story of that, and I'm happy to tell more of the long story of that, is that the United States Army has a classified unit. It's an intelligence unit. Their job is to basically see the future faster. And it's a very diverse group of folks. You might have a kind of stereotype in your mind about what a special operator looks like, you know, big beard, kind of like Viking type thing. And there are definitely those folks in special operations. But you don't know that a lot of folks in special operations are women. And so I got to work with this group as they were seeing the future faster. And what they said to me is, we've noticed that your research, Angus, is really different. And we think that you're either seeing the future faster or you're a total crank and a lunatic. And we want to bring you inside and we want to test your research to see if any of it is actually true. Do you want to come and test it with us? And so, of course, I said yes. And I got taken inside. It was the beginning of a truly extraordinary relationship. The United States Army basically went through and validated all these zany ideas that I had. And part of the reason that they did it is it really squared with a lot of stuff that they themselves had seen. A lot of folks don't know this. The United States Army invented the computer, basically. They were the ones who funded ENIAC back during World War II. They essentially also invented artificial intelligence. They invented generative AI, again, back in World War II, when they paid someone whose name is J.P. Guilford to develop divergent and convergent thinking, which is the basis of ideation, which is the basis of generative AI. So they'd seen all this stuff, and they'd had it in the basement for years, and they knew that it was smart, but that humans were smarter. And what they also knew is that over the last 20 years, folks who were coming into the special operations pipeline, young folks, were having a harder and harder time transitioning into becoming operators. They were having less initiative, less imagination, less ability to handle chaotic and volatile situations. They were struggling more with their emotions. They were struggling more with substance use. And they realized that something weird was happening in America. And so they basically thought, hey, you know, we agree with you, Angus. Let's see if the stuff you're proposing works. And I don't want to pretend like everything I thought worked. but I do want to say that in partnership with the United States Army, we were able to develop a program that did work. And that they were then able to take outside of special operations, put it in conventional Army, and then we started putting it in schools, you know, Worthington District here, and we now have a partnership with Columbus City Schools. We're going to start to kind of roll it out there. And it's a super simple program, but it's really all just about getting you back in touch with that part of yourself that tells new stories.
So let's explore that for a second under the lens of AI and what is happening, where it is not necessarily the elephant in the room, but it is here. It is prevalent. Everyone is talking about it and thinking about it. Quite simply, if you could say, what can AI do and what can it not do?
Computers get smarter the more information you give them. So if you're in an environment that is transparent and stable, an environment that doesn't change, AI is going to win every time. If you're in an environment where things are changing, the one rule about a changing environment is that you need to change too. You need to do something new. That's the human edge. The human edge is the ability to embrace change and volatility and turn it into growth. And what's happening now in the world is people are scared of doing that, and people are struggling to do that because we've lost touch with who we are. We've lost touch with our nature. And a lot of that is due to over-reliance on technology. And this is the kind of the paradox of technology. I'm not someone who thinks technology is bad. I'm not someone who thinks that AI is bad. But I do think that the more we rely on technology, the less we develop our own ability to do the things that we're good at. And so the reason there's so much crisis around AI, I think, is first of all, people are starting to realize that AI is actually not that great. I don't know how much time you have spent with AI. I mean, one of the reasons I work with the Army is because AI always shatters in edge cases. It always shatters when things change. You would never have an AI be a leader. You could have an AI be a manager. You could have an AI optimize a stable existing system and do kind of repetitive rote tasks, but you'd never have an AI be an innovator.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. AI is getting smarter, but are we? What if the future doesn't belong to people who can outcalculate machines, but to people who can outimagine them? In a world dominated by algorithms and automation, what makes us irreplaceably human? We're finding out this week from our featured panelist, Angus Fletcher, professor of story science in the Department of English at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of the new book, Primal Intelligence. Your host is Siraj Hinduja, managing director of RTRX. We'll get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Primal Intelligence, the Human Edge in an AI World, after a short break.
Hi, I'm Raghav Raj. I'm the student intern here at 90.5 WCBE. Did you know that you can tune into this show on WCBE's new app? Whether you're on the go or staying home, the WCBE app lets you listen to our programming online anytime. For local music, community news, and original podcasts, find WCBE on the App Store or the Google Play Store today.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. AI is getting smarter, but are we? What if the future doesn't belong to people who can out-calculate machines, but to people who can out-imagine them? In a world dominated by algorithms and automation, what makes us irreplaceably human? We're finding out this week from our featured panelist, Angus Fletcher, professor of story science in the Department of English at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of the new book, Primal Intelligence. Your host is Suraj Hinduja, managing director of RTRX. Let's get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Primal Intelligence, the human edge in an AI world.
So I think a lot of folks are starting to see the limits of AI. And then there's a certain kind of like weird emotional relief you have. You're like, oh my goodness, it's not going to take over. But then you're like, but what else is going to solve the problem? I don't know how to solve the problem anymore because I've lost touch with who I am. And so there's this kind of crisis that people are having where we both kind of do want AI to solve all our problems for us, you know, and we're just realizing it's probably not. So, you know, a big part of what I do with young folks is just start to walk them back through the discovery process that their ancestors would have had, to start to light up the parts of the brain that go active when you take a walk in nature. Start to help them in addition to developing their initiative. So what allows you to take initiative is a power in your brain called intuition, and intuition is your ability to spot an opportunity. And an opportunity is the leading edge of the future. And what allows you to see that is your ability to value things that you don't understand and that are different from you. And technology does the opposite of that. Technology skips over exceptions. It regresses them to the mean. As an adult, you spend a lot of your time judging stuff that's an exception. You're like, that's weird. That's odd. Or that makes me insecure. I better crush it before it somehow threatens me, you know? As a young person, you want to lean into the fact, I don't understand what that is. That's different, that's interesting, I wanna chase that. And so we spend a lot of time in natural environments starting to kind of activate that. Going along with that, the second most critical thing is emotional confidence. You develop emotional confidence by getting yourself out of failure. And as a young person, before the age of 2, you're doing this all the time. Pretty much everything you do when you're an infant is failing. You know, you're trying to communicate to people that you're hungry, they're not listening, you're trying to walk, you're falling over, banging your head, like failure, 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 failure. And then all of a sudden you enter a world where your parents are expecting you to be perfect, get good grades, you know. You're entering a world where all of a sudden technology makes life frictionless. You're not struggling or wrestling all the time. When you do start to struggle and wrestle, I have all these conversations all the time, unfortunately, with my undergrads, who I love. But they have all these relationship problems, you know, with each other. And you're always coming to my office and being like, my girlfriend is a paranoid narcissist. I'm like, whoa. It's like, how do you know that? She doesn't like the same TV shows that I like. And? No, that's it, man. She doesn't like the same TV shows that I like. And what's happening there is when you spend a lot of time in technology, you're used to having yourself emotionally gratified immediately. Because the technology always does what you want it to do. Also, starting with Steve Jobs, I like Steve Jobs. I mean, not anymore, obviously he's passed, but you know, I'm not opposed to Steve Jobs. The whole purpose of Steve Jobs is something called user experience, user design. That means that the technology is supposed to please you and actually make you feel like you're a god. So people love their cell phones because they're like, oh, I'm so powerful, look at all the things I can do. AI is engineered to make you feel smart when it's actually making you dumber, but you feel smart. So all these technologies are making you feel, oh, life is so easy, life is so easy. And then you go have a conversation with your spouse or your kids and they don't do exactly what you want. And you're like, oh my God, they must be dumb, you know? Or there must be something wrong with me. And it's like, no, there's nothing wrong with anybody. Friction. Friction is the source of growth. Friction is the source of having real conversations, discomfort. So all that comes from failure. The ability to harness discomfort comes from failure, from remembering previous times that you were uncomfortable, from remembering previous times when you had a fight with your partner and then you made up and actually strengthened your relationship. So a big part of being a young person is developing your mental library of times that you failed and then turned it around. Or developing a mental catalog of times when the world disappointed you, but then you figured out how to make it better. And what we know from looking at leaders, people who are successful, so we did all this stuff with the U.S. Army. And one of the things the Army is fascinated with, because the Army is so pragmatic, it's one of the things I love about the Army. You just get in a room with them, and they're like, okay, we have these problems to solve right now. Let's solve them. And you're like, okay, all right, let's solve the problems. And so one of the things that they're obsessed with is leadership. how do you train successful leaders? And so we spent a lot of time looking at young folks who are put in these leadership positions in military situations. And it's really terrifying to be a young person in a military situation, life and death, other people's lives, not just your own life. I think we spend a lot of time when we think about the military thinking, oh, like, how would I do that? I would be so afraid of myself dying. A huge part of being in the military is like, I'm sending someone else to possibly die. And starting to deal with the gravity of those decisions. And so what we saw is that some young folks were better at it than others. And the number one difference in terms of what was going on in their brains, people who failed, young leaders who failed, failed because when something went wrong, they focused on what was going wrong and tried to push it forward into the future and fix it. In other words, they were future focused. People who were successful were past focused. And what they did is they jumped back to a previous moment when they'd handled a challenge like that, they gathered their emotional confidence, and then they stepped forward. And almost all of you will have this experience. So, for example, I'm terrified of speaking in public. I don't know if you guys can tell that. I have terrible stage fright.
Every time, and here we are.
I have to speak in public all the time, which is why you hear me say it all the time. But I'm terrified of speaking in public. I literally, my mind goes blank when I'm up on stage. And people are like, oh, but you seem so relaxed on stage. How do you do that? Literally the thing I do every time before I step up on stage is I remember the last time I stepped up on stage. And I was like, it seemed to work out okay. Nobody died, you know? And your memories of those moments when you succeeded give you that emotional boost in your brain. They activate the neural pathways. They carry you forward. We screw this up in the modern world because a lot of times we spend giving young people role models. Role models are stories of other people who succeeded in those situations. When your brain thinks of a role model, it's like, that person is awesome. I'm not that person. You know, I can't do that. When your brain thinks of its own successes, it's like, I did do that, I can't do that, I'm becoming my own role model. And so the only way to become your own role model is to change school so that it's not about taking tests, but it's about these experiences in failure and having the experience of getting something wrong and then fixing it yourself. And then having the teacher pause you and say, hey, remember that story? Right? Because, you know, your brain thinks a story. Remember that story of how you succeeded? Lock that in. That's now part of your life story. And if you hold on to that story of your past, it's going to help you build the story of your future.
Great. Now, I'm going to ask one last question. But as many of you know, the conversation here at CMC is a two-way street. And so Doug is there with the microphone for folks in the audience here to ask a question. If you have a question for Angus, please head to Doug. Or if you are online, please submit your questions. As a former camp counselor and former orientation leader at Ohio State, I'm going to kindly request that at least one question comes from the young leaders that we have in the audience. I'm going to put you on the spot, but I want you to come up to the stage or to the microphone and ask a question. Before we do that, you talked about problems that the Special Forces have asked you to help solve. There's one that is related to, we were all taught in school, who, what, when, where, why. I want you to talk about the problem that you were asked to solve and how you used who, what, when, there, who, what, when, where, why to solve it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what Suraj is talking about is after I'd worked with Special Operations for a couple of years, I got a phone call from an operator. And the phone call, as all these phone calls go, was basically, Angus. And I was like, Tom. And he was like, Angus, we've got a problem. Specifically, we've got a problem with our wives. Or maybe our wives have a problem with us. It's unclear. Anyway, the point is, we have a 90% divorce rate in our unit. And I was like, you have a 90% divorce rate in your unit? And he was like, well, actually, it's probably a lot worse than that. It's probably over 200% because most of us have been married multiple times. But the point is, we're having a problem in the unit. And I was like, okay. And he's like, we want you to help us. And I was like, all right, well, I mean, I can get you a marriage counselor or something. They were like, no. We don't trust them. We trust you. And this,
not a marriage counselor.
That's literally what I said. And also, I had a couple of conversations with friends of mine who are marriage counselors. So, like, if there's one thing you don't want to do, it's marriage counseling. Like, literally. Like, it's like the worst thing in the world. But one of the funny things about working with operators is once they trust you, they trust you. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, one of them trusted me sometimes to do, like, open heart surgery or something like that. You know, they'd be like, Angus, we trust you. I'm not a heart surgeon. It's okay. We trust you. Here's a can opener. Fix my heart. So anyway, next thing I know, I, get thrown in the back of a van, driven to an undisclosed location, which I can tell all of you was a field in the middle of nowhere. And in this field were 150, 200 couples. So these were operators and their spouses. And then Tom comes over. And Tom is like, Angus. And I'm like, Tom. And he's like, Angus, you see these folks out here? They're all about to get divorced unless you stop that from happening right now. Here's the microphone. Go. And I was like, what is happening? So I actually panicked. And then I was like, what can I do in this situation? Because part of the training that we give young folks is just like take the first step that occurs to you. If you can't think of anything else to do, just take the first step that occurs to you. And the first step that occurred to me was basically that folks in these units built camaraderie through conversations. And what we'd noticed in particular about those conversations was those conversations asked a lot of who, what, when, where questions, but they never asked why questions. And the reason they never asked why questions is the moment you ask why, you surface a judgment. And you're actually shutting down the conversation because instead of exploring further, you're tying it off and moving it on. And so because all these folks in the community are essentially, a lot of them were trained essentially as interrogators, and they sort of continued that habit of conversation with each other where they were basically sort of grilling each other and surfacing interesting things. And what we noticed is that when they found something that surprised them or interested them, they wanted to know more about it. So, they would say, well, when did that start? Or how often does that happen? And they would hold off why as long as possible. And so we put all these folks in the field together. I said, hey, run this exercise where you ask each other who, what, when, where, but you never ask each other why. And I meant that as a delaying exercise, just so I could actually figure out something to actually have happen. They were still talking 30 minutes later. And these were folks who had never, in the last two or three years, had a conversation that went beyond one partner telling the other person what to do, essentially. And the reason for that is they'd lost the ability to be interested in the other person. And they were only interested in having the answer immediately. And you see this a lot, I think, in our world today, is we dehumanize each other by treating other people as vehicles for us to get what we want. I want something. I want information. I want a task done. So I want to know what words I can say to have you do the thing that I want to do now, as opposed to what the opportunity is you're a mystery for me to discover. You have a story I don't know. And when I start to learn your story, I also start to learn more about my own story, because I'm realizing what I don't know about myself in conversation with you. You've had this experience when you have a friend. You learn more about yourself, not just about the other person. And then you start to join together a new story. And then that new story is what carries you forward. And after we did this with special operators, we started doing this with regular couples. We actually found that the largest indicator that someone is going to get a divorce is essentially that they think that they already know why their partner is doing something. So if you hear that your partner has done something and everyone else is like, that's kind of odd, and you're like, no, it's not odd. I know exactly why they're doing it. You're making a judgment. You've fallen out of love. Whereas love is built on the sense that I actually don't know. There's more to discover in this person. So for any of you who wanted to deepen a relationship you're in right now, just try this. And you don't have to make it too complicated. You can literally just focus on asking more what questions and less why questions. If you want to make it more complicated, you can ask more what, when, where, how questions and less why questions. But try and stop yourself from making a judgment and try and hold open your curiosity window for as long as you can.
Awesome. Now time for our questions, Doug.
Speaking of questions, Suraj, thank you so much. Angus, thank you so much. Great conversation today. If you'd like to ask a question, please do join us here at the microphone. We'll try to get to as many questions as possible. If you're watching online on YouTube, please type your questions into the chat. We'll try to get to those. Great questions at CMC can always be asked in just a few seconds. And what punctuation mark does a good question or any question actually end with? They end with question marks. Yes, they do. Here we go.
Thank you. My first question, or my only question, is you said something about artists not being archetypal. Can you explain that a little bit, please?
Yeah. So when I was growing up in school, what we were always taught is that stories followed a series of eternal formulas. So the hero's journey, or tragedy, or comedy, or something like that. And then we were taught that there were a series of these archetypal characters. The king, the jester, the joker, these sorts of things. And if you go online now or you ask an AI to tell you about a story, they'll just disgorge tons and tons of these archetypes. And there's a lot of origins to these, but mostly they originate in the mind of a totally brilliant early 20th century psychologist. His name is Jung, if you guys haven't heard of Carl Jung. Brilliant man, brilliant mind. And his theory of story archetypes is and was for him, very fertile because at the time it was new. But it's based on an idea that's totally wrong scientifically. The idea is that there's an eternal consciousness which links all of us together and that these archetypes are just kind of resurfacing over and over again. What we know about life, for better or for worse, is that life is always changing. And that the reason that story evolved in the human brain is to help us make new plans. Because a new plan is a new plot, is a new story. And so a huge part of being a human is your ability to realize that every person in your life is not an archetype. They're an original. They're a new character. You're a new character. You can tell a new story. Different cultures tell new stories. There are voices out there now who are imagining new stories. And so archetypes can be useful in the sense that, you know, in the same way that any standard model can be helpful at getting something off the ground or could be useful in a kind of, you know, fast or expedient moment. If you're not trying to reinvent the wheel, there's no problem with using a wheel when you're building a car. But it's important to realize that there's going to be forms of transportation in the future that don't involve wheels. And it's the same thing with stories. And so the reason I resist archetypes is because they're the idea that somehow all knowledge exists in the past. There's nothing new for us to grow and discover. There's no possible stories for us to invent. And we know that that's both biologically untrue and also personally joyless.
Thank you. My name is Katie. I'm an animation student at Columbus College of Art and Design. So my dream industry is to tell stories that impact people. I'm also here on behalf of my Cultivating Your Creative Leadership course at our school. So regarding all of that, what advice would you have for everyone to be more creative as a leader outside of just being in a creative industry? Or what creative habits do you think everyone could practice every day to fuel their own internal creativity to make these impactful stories?
Well, first of all, it sounds like you're already a very creative leader, and it sounds like you're doing all the things you need to do. So I'm going to direct this advice to the old people in the audience, you know, who don't have kind of your... So the key to realize is that every leader leads in their own way. Every leader leads in their own way. And if you go online, you go to Harvard Business School, you go to any kind of leadership course, they'll be like, here are the three attributes of a leader. Here's what a successful leader always does. If you ever meet a leader, you realize that they're totally original. And that's because what is a leader? A leader is somebody who does something first. They take the first step into the unknown. A leader is by definition not a follower. Therefore, they are an original. And so a big part of being a leader is looking back on through your own life story and being like, what are the things that I did that other people questioned or thought were weird but made me proud? What are the parts of myself that other people don't understand that I'm going to double down on? And then once you're doing that, the next and most critical step of being a leader is to realize that the purpose of a leader is to make other leaders. And so what you do as a leader is you then look around at everyone in your circle and you empower them to be themselves. You empower them to double down on what's different and unique about themselves. You say, that's what leadership is. So start with what's unique about yourself. Encourage others to be unique themselves.
Hello, my name is Olabanji Lamid. I attend Northland High School and Downtown High School, and I'm also a part of the Superintendent Student Ambassadors. Your story reminded me of a time when I, it was the time when I had to go to ninth grade, and I was deciding between a school focused on body or studying the body or a STEM focused school. And at that time I chose the STEM focused school because it was more of a career path. While the body is or school focused on learning about the body, it was more focused on how I was gonna improve myself, because at that time I was really introverted and I was trying to figure out how to learn to be more extroverted really. And so based off of that, What do you think that causes humans to want to change, really?
What do I think causes humans to want to change? Awesomeness, the desire to grow. I mean, I want to really congratulate you for saying what you just said and for having that self-awareness and that reflectiveness, and also looking at yourself and being like, hey, you know, by the way, there's nothing wrong with being an introvert. I also have to be honest, not to be a total downer, but introvert and extrovert, also made up by Carl Jung. There is no such thing as an introvert or an extrovert. I understand these are useful and fun labels for referring to ourselves as. But what you're basically saying is, you wanted to be a little more social. and you wanted to kind of get out, and you wanted to like stand up at a microphone in a public place and kind of express what was unique about yourself. And so what happened is there was a tension between the story of yourself that you knew and the story of yourself you imagined. There was a conflict. And then you leaned into that conflict and you used it to power growth. And this is the secret to story. Every story starts with a conflict. What do computers do? They eliminate conflict. The modern world, we're terrified of conflict. We think that if we have an argument with our partner, there must be something wrong. When in reality, that's servicing a valuable source of growth for the relationship. So life wants to grow. Humans want to grow. That's where change comes from. And just as you discovered, the engine of that change is identifying a conflict in yourself or a conflict between you and the world. And then instead of pretending like that conflict doesn't exist, embracing it with joy, embracing it with openness, and using it to leverage something new.
Hello, my name is Bethany Ellis. I am a superintendent student ambassador of Columbus City Schools. I was really, you know, focused on the beginning of your story because I actually want to go into neuroscience when I graduate high school. And with that, I was wondering, at what point do you think a researcher becomes morally responsible for how their work is used, especially when it's adapted to something like how you said that your work was used in the U.S. military?
Yeah, this is a real question as a scientist. You know, scientists split the atom, and now we have the atom bomb. I work a lot with someone called Martin Seligman. He's a big mentor of mine. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. He developed a theory called learned helplessness, which was meant to help people get out of learned helplessness, but was instead used by various regimes to create learned helplessness in people. At the end of the day, as a scientist, I think you have to realize that you're part of a larger community, a larger world. And I think you have to realize that what holds communities together is trust. And at the bottom of trust is mutual respect. And so what I hope is that by participating in science as part of a democratic America, and by a democratic America, I mean an America that values all the things that democracies do, values individuals, wants to celebrate individuals, I hope that my research will do more good than harm. But it is always a danger in life. And the reason it's a danger is because when people get threatened, a lot of times they go into their worst selves. And when they go into their worst selves, they're going to leverage anything they can as a source of power. And nothing is more powerful than knowledge. Nothing is more powerful than science. That's why people reach to science in times of crisis. So I think ultimately, at the end of the day, as a scientist, you want to do your research. You want to be part of a community that is a democratic community. And you also want to do everything that you can to create a climate of emotional security in folks so it gives them more of an opportunity to be their best selves. But I totally agree with you. That's a great concern. And I'm really pleased to know that even as a young scientist, you're thinking that far into the future.
And I think a wonderful wrap up to our conversation, Angus. Thank you again for your work, for your vulnerability, for maybe challenging the status quo and the courage that it takes to have this conversation and to share it. And with that, I will turn it back to Sophia.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, we explored what makes humans uniquely capable in an AI-driven world. Joining us this week, Angus Fletcher, professor of story science in the Department of English at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of the new book, Primal Intelligence. Your host was Suraj Hinduja, managing director of RTRX. This week's forum partner was the Columbus Futurists. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. The Columbus Dispatch was our live stream partner. Additional support was provided by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you finish Angus Fletcher's new book, Primal Intelligence, and you'd like to keep exploring this week's forum topic, our friends at the Columbus Metropolitan Library also recommend reading The Atomic Human by Neil Lawrence. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I hope you'll join us. I'm Doug Buchanan. Thanks for listening.